the tragedy that strikes, the trouble endured, or the affliction that has come upon this man, is the tragedy worse, or is the questioning that goes on in a man's mind over that tragedy worse? Or is the aggravation and the hurt that comes into his life because of what his friends say worse? Or is it all bad? I mean, do they all go together? Can you have one without the other? It is a combination. I think the thing that gets the more discussion in this book is, you notice how easily we have gone from sympathy over what Job has suffered to argument over principles about how life works. And that would say that I think that we have a harder time actually keeping on the subject when we're dealing with the why questions about this. Why has this happened to me? And why can't somebody do something about it? And why at least can't my friends show me kindness? We've seen all of that so far. Remember, again, that what's under examination in the book of Job is whether any relationship between God and man is possible. What's at stake here is the relationship between God and man. And the laboratory for this examination is a fiery trial, an unimaginably fiery trial upon the best of men, Job. Only Job and his friends don't realize what the real issue is. They think that the real issue is just, why has all this happened to Job? And is Job excusable for saying the things he says as he struggles through this? So we have that situation. Now, the first friend has heard all of Job's whys in chapter 3. And that friend has said basically, from what I know of God's Word, from what's been revealed, people reap what they sow, and you are being disciplined, Job. Job responds to that with, I have seen situations where wicked people do not reap what they sow, and I haven't done anything to deserve this harsh of discipline. All right? And then he has expressed himself more fully to God, and for the first time in this book, Job, beginning at chapter 7 and verse 11, speaks openly, directly to God, and he says this phrase that comes up, I loathe my life. And he wants to know, why are you making so much of me? If I've done something wrong, why not pardon it and let me go? Now that leads to the second part of the conversation between Job and the second friend, Bildad, the Shuhite. And Bildad takes a little bit different, not only a different track of reasoning than Eliphaz does, but a different tone of voice while he does it. With any poetry, biblical or otherwise, you need to try to imagine the tone of voice as you read it. Right? And that some of that is, that's the work that you put into it. I imagine when I read Eliphaz, the first friend, him being a little kinder and gentler. But Bildad has heard Job say in Job 5 and verse 26 something that he's picked up on. He's heard Job say, if you notice, it's not 5:26, it is 4, and the passage where he talked about a man's words being wind, not 4, maybe at least it, with Job, I mean, 6:26. I was in the neighborhood. I hear your pages turning. 6:26. Do you think you can reprove words when the speech of a despairing man is wind? Job said, I'm talking about how I feel. And notice that that's what Bildad picks up on. Chapter 8, verse 2. How long will you say these things, talking to Job, and the words of your mouth be a great wind? In other words, if you realize that you've only spoken wind, why are you keeping it up? That idea. And imagine the sympathy or lack thereof in that statement. Now, Bildad lays down the principal argument that he wants to make in verse 3. Tim, would you mind to read for us?
Does God pervert justice? Or does the Almighty pervert what is right?
All right. Bildad is therefore going to not comfort Job, but defend what? God's justice in particular. To him, what is at stake then is not Job's agony that he's going through and Job's loss. To him, what is at stake is whether God can be regarded as justly ruling his world. To Bildad, Job's questions have basically bordered on the denial of God's justice and God's rightness. Notice carefully that to Bildad, God's justice and righteousness is determined by whether people get a return on their investment in him. Now, where have we heard that argument before? All right, Satan is the one who said, people only serve you when you pay them off. Who, therefore, is behind the argument, the temptation toward Job in this argument by Bildad? Does Satan know how to quote Scripture? Oh, yes. Does Satan know how to seem like he's defending God? Remember the way he tempted Jesus in the wilderness. That's the idea here. So he can take something which is right, that is the idea that God is just, and misapply its meaning. He can take something that is right and use it as an argument for man to do what is wrong. And that's a part of the terrible circumstance of this. Now, in verses 4 through 7, Bildad uses the if-then line of thought in applying what he regards as the principle of God's justice. And the if might be even put since, and it be understood even better. Look at this. Verse 4. If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. All right, now that on at first light, that would appear to be just if your children were to happen to ever sin. But what do we know here? What? All right, they're gone. Therefore, what in so many words, what's Bildad saying to Job? All right, the fact that they are gone proves that they were sinners, and that God, being just, is the one who has done this to them. All right, you see that the assumption that's there. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and right, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. And though your beginning was small, your latter days will be great. Both Bildad and Eliphaz have now argued that something is wrong with Job, and that if he will correct that, then he has a glorious, wonderful future experience. I mean, that's the idea. Job, everything can be turned around in Job's life if he will be pure and right. Now, why does that kind of thought put so much pressure on Job in the situation he's in?
He's been threatening you right all along.
All right. What the idea is that the agony and grief, the agony of his and grief of his loss, then the pain of his physical circumstance is complicated by the doubts about his spiritual standing. And that is complicated by the questions about whether God exists and is in control, and whether there is any reason to his rule or not. You can kind of see that. Now, the question that comes is, how does Bildad know this? Upon what basis is he reasoning or arguing? So if verse 3 is the principal argument that he makes, verse 8 and following lays down the foundation of his thinking, where he gets this. Remember, Eliphaz argued because he had seen a vision or had something revealed to him in the night. Look at verse 8 through 10. Travis, read for us, and everybody notice the basis of this man's thought.
For inquire, please, of bygone ages, and consider what the fathers have searched out. For we are but of yesterday and know nothing, for our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and utter words out of their understanding?
All right, what's the basis of his reasoning here? What's the text, if you will, for his the proof of his argument to him?
History.
All right, especially the understanding of bygone ages or what the fathers have searched out would be regarded as wisdom. The wise men, the people who have already lived. Now, in other words, we are in no position to question or to question that conclusion that they've reached, or to decide whether it applies in this present problem. Just bypass all of that and say, this is what we have always thought. They will teach you what your situation is and give you some sense of understanding. Now, the argument is that God doesn't pervert justice, that he'll do what's right. The reason is because this is what the wise men have always taught us. And now the application is to how Bildad thinks life works. And notice the illustration. Verse 13, the last half of the verse, I think, is the crux of his reasoning here. What does he say? The hope of the godless shall perish. That's his argument. Now, here's his illustrations. Verse 11 and 12, he has the idea in his mind of a river in that dry country at the time. And at the high water mark of that river, all of the grass and the reeds and so forth grow along the bank, and they're green and they're flourishing and all of that. And then the drier season comes, and the river water level goes down, and it leaves that grass and reeds standing on the bank up here, and it all starts to die. All right? And Bildad is saying, that's the way the godless man is. Job, you may look around and think that God is not, that this is not how life works, but you're overlooking the fact that that's just how these godless people are at the moment. The dry season will come and they'll all wither up. That's his first argument. His second illustration, verse 14. He says that the confidence of that godless man is like a spider's web. Or some of the versions may even say a spider's house. Anybody who leans against it, it won't stand. How you like to think of the security of your life like a spider's web? All it needs is somebody to walk through it, or for the wind blow real hard and it'll be gone. And then the next thing, the third illustration, verses 16 and following, is somebody whose entire approach to life is in physical things. It's like the plant that grows up with the roots in the house, and then the old house caves in, and everything begins to decay. Verse 19 is hard to translate, but and hard to figure out maybe, but that's the general idea. So in other words, here's the chapter, if we can summarize it. God does not pervert justice, so you ought to do right, and He'll respond to you. The reason I know this is what we've always been taught. The godless man may seem to do well for a moment, but it's like the grass along, his life's like the grass along the river, like the spider's web, and like an old barn that falls in. And then he draws the conclusion to his thought, verses 20 and 21, especially 20 to 22. We read these three verses in this chapter. All right, David, read for us.
Lo, God will not reject a man of integrity, nor will he support the evildoer. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more.
All right, verse 21 may be the closest thing that this man makes to a word of sympathy to Job. He'll yet fill your mouth with laughter. But it assumes still a challenge to Job's integrity. Notice verse 21, God will not reject a blameless man. This version says blameless is the word for integrity. It's the thing that Satan is challenging and using against Job all along. God says Job will hold fast his integrity. Satan says no, he won't. Each one of his friends now have challenged Job's integrity or used it against him. Eliphaz did it in chapter 8, chapter 4, verse 6. Bildad does it in chapter 8, verse 20 now. The problem is, how is Job feeling at this moment? When Bildad says, God will not reject a blameless man, nor take the hand of evildoers, how is Job feeling right at that moment? What has he been saying? All right, that's part of it, I think. All right, Job is feeling like he has been rejected. All right, now, that means that Job is feeling like either A, he is a man who is found to be without integrity, or B, God is not treating him according to his integrity. And in either way, it puts his mind in a vice, if you think about it. One of them causes him to doubt his own being, and the other one causes him to doubt his theology, if you will, his understanding of God. So that's the situation that we're found in. Now, what's your feeling about Bildad's counsel in chapter 8? Would that encourage you or comfort you if you were Job, and why or why not? What did Bildad do that you wish he would not have done if you were Job? How might Bildad have improved his counsel to a hurting man? All right, say it. What?
Why not?
Bildad could have done best by not talking. Another one. Okay, that's possible. Can anybody else?
Would have encouraged him and told him to hang in there, you're a good person.
All right, that would be putting the focus on Job and not on the things that he had heard Job say, right? If he would have tried to get attention back on sympathy for what Job was going through, and instead of trying to argue with Job's expressions of his complaints, then he would have been more helpful in what he was saying and more in tune with that actual circumstance. I think it's important for us to see that Bildad says some things that are not always wrong. He just assumes that this is Job's situation right now. He assumed more than he really knew, which is a part of the problem here. Anybody else with an observation about this man's guidance? Yes.
Well, one thing I was thinking, if I was Bildad and knew that Job was a righteous man already, these things could happen to me tomorrow.
Yes. Yeah.
Same things could happen to me.
So he failed to ask, failed to use the golden rule. He failed to say, what if this were me? Yeah. All right, anybody else?
I think Bildad was a bit critical in the beginning of his conversation about Job when he's talking about his sons. Nothing could have happened to them, or your words are just wind. He just started out with more of a positive. And I think it's been touched on in the comments we've made so far.
If it could start it out with, usually if somebody starts out with something to say about your children, it's not going to be very encouraging from that point onward. And that's probably true. Bildad also made the mistake of thinking that everything Job was saying was an argument from Job's mind, instead of realizing that some of it was an expression of Job's hurt. And that lack of focus hurts. Now, Let's try to look through Job's answer to this for a few minutes now in chapters 9 and 10. This whole book is remember, the bad things happen in the first two chapters, and the rest of it is talking about what this means in God's providence. Job's answer to Bildad, it says, truly, begins verse 2, truly I know that it is so. What does he mean by that?
He named Bildad was right.
Alright, he's right about what? Job is confessing his agreement with the general principle of God's justice. Job is recognizing or granting Bildad that God won't reject a blameless man and so forth, as verse 20 says. The question, though, that still is left unsatisfied is this one. How can a man be in the right before God? Tell me what Job means by that.
He thought he was doing what he was supposed to do, and then, you know, it's like, what else can I do?
All right. Remember, if what is at stake in this book is man's relationship with God, then what Job is being led to have to ask here is whether such a thing is possible. If God strictly rules based on justice, and if God will not reject a blameless man and won't take the hand of an evildoer, the question is, but can a man ever be blameless? Can a man, before this God, ever be in the right? Now, if he says, if somebody wished to contend with God, you couldn't. God is wise, in verse 4, and he is mighty, and nobody, if you think about it, could succeed in contending with God. Who could file a suit against God and succeed? John?
Thing neat about this is it sets the stage for what Christ does. It really shows you how miraculous what he did.
All right, this chapter does that. We'll get to one key verse in this chapter that does that maybe more clearly than anything, any other part of the Old Testament in some ways. you're right about that. Look at what he says about God's wisdom and his might in verses 4 through 10 here. I'll not read the whole section, but he overturns mountains, he shakes the earth, verse 6, he commands the sun, and he seals up the stars, verse 7, he stretches out the heaven, he tramples the waves, verse 8, he made the constellations, verse 9, and rules over them. He does great things beyond searching out, and marvelous things without number, verse 10. So Job grants the majesty of God, right? What is he doing in that statement that Bildad has neglected to do in chapter 8?
Give glory to where glory is due.
Say it louder for me.
Give glory to where glory is due.
All right, I think that's partly. There is another important part about the framing of the discussion that he is doing that Bildad neglected to do. Bildad is talking about God as if man is perfectly capable of grasping and describing what God does and how he does it. Job is saying God is of such majesty and wisdom and power that what he does will be infinite, that is, it will be beyond our grasp. In other words, like Isaiah puts it in Isaiah 55, God's ways are higher than our ways, and God's thoughts are higher than our thoughts. Therefore, will God ever, in His sovereign rule, will He ever have purposes, or will He ever do things that are perhaps a little beyond us? Yes.
Do I even have any right to be questioning God about what he's doing?
Well, Job may be confessing that he is not on equal ground with God in order to be able to do that. But the point is, Bildad is assuming that right. Bildad is assuming that he's in a position to explain God. Now look at verse 11. What Job says is that God, in His wisdom and power, and His rule of all things, passes by me and I see Him not. What's He mean by that? If you go back to chapter 8 and verse 4, Bildad said, if you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you're pure and right, He'll rouse Himself for you. Job is saying, I know that all that may be right, but how can a man be right with God, and with a God so great, so mighty, and so wise, he passes me by and I don't see him. How am I going to take hold of him? How am I going to seek him? That's the implication. Who can turn him back? Who'll say to him, what are you doing? Verse 12. So verse 14, how can I then answer him, choosing my words with him? And that's the question. How can man, when things are going on that he doesn't understand, how can he engage in the necessary struggle for understanding with God? I think that's a big question. If you read the Psalms of the Old Testament, many of them are classified as laments, and they are the expression of the confusion over the human condition and the struggle to figure out, where am I? And if God does know me and pay attention to me, then where am I in the great scheme of things and the way the world works, and what does my life really mean? And that's what's at stake in a lot of what Job is saying, not merely the hurt that he's going through, but the why. All right, now look at verses 15 through 18. This begins a part of the darker part of this book that paints God in the worst light. If you think about this, Jan, would you read for us?
Job
15 through 18.
For though I were right, I could not answer. I would have to implore the mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I could not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he bruises me with the tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not allow me to get my breath, but saturates me with bitterness.
All right, look at that idea there. Verse 15 starts with an important conviction still. What?
He's okay with God.
Job still says, though I'm in the right, but he is like a man who is being treated too harshly and has no means of resolving the situation. He has no way of seeking a resolution to his case, if you notice that. That fills him with bitterness. Now, he pictures in verses 19 and following, he pictures it being an unfair, an impossible situation for him. The God who crushes him with the tempest without cause, verse 17, won't let him get his breath, verse 18, is more powerful than Job, verse 19. And then verse 20 and 21, I want you to notice the recurrence of that same word that we've been focused on. Verse 20 and 21. What does he say? Though I'm in the right, my own mouth would condemn me. That is, if he were trying to summon God or have an argument with God, though I may be what?
Guiltless.
The word is blameless. It's the same word that's translated integrity or a form of it. He would prove me perverse. In other words, since no man can be right before God, even my trying to argue my case would be for me to be found rejected. And verse 22 leads to maybe the summation of Job's point here. This verse 22 is the reply to chapter 8, verse 3. All right? What does he say, verse 22?
Everybody's going to meet them.
All right, he says it's all one. Therefore, I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. What's he mean by that now? Bildad said, God doesn't pervert justice. The Almighty doesn't pervert what's right. He deals with people based on their rightness or wrongness. Job says, same thing happens to the right and the wrong. It's all one. Therefore, I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. That means, then, that righteousness means nothing. And if righteousness means nothing, what does life mean? Nothing. And if life means nothing, what does a hurting man sitting there in agony say about his life? The end of verse 21. I hate my life. I loathe my life. And he says that two or three times now. So, do you see the emptiness of grief in what this man is saying at this point? He has now suffered all the loss, and instead of their encouraging him and their saying to him, there's still something to believe in, he's now struggling with the question of whether there is anything to believe in. Brother Feeney?
If we take these cases here of his friends, I don't believe we should go visit this sick.
Okay.
If we're going to do like these three friends,
well,
I think it's a good lesson for all of us.
Yes, it is a good lesson. And a very important part of this book is, if you go see your friends, pay attention to their condition and not what they... whether they're saying things that you're comfortable with or not, understand that some of that is giving voice to pain Listen to it, but support them. And he's right. One of my favorite examples, and I mean this to be humorous, but two people that I loved, and Brother Feeney knew both of them, Everett D. Lowe and Fred Wilson. And they were a pair, knocked on more doors in this town probably than anybody, but they always were carrying on with each other. And Everett was a diabetic. He had it really bad. He'd already in diabetic shock circumstances. He'd wrecked his old truck twice and totaled it once and was in bad shape. And Fred had a heart problem and had to have bypass surgery. And back in those days, depression went very commonly with recovery from that kind of surgery. And Fred was really weak and having a hard time, and took him home, and he would sit in his living room in his recliner and hardly had energy to do anything. Everett decided to go see him. And Everett pulled up in his driveway, lived on a little slope like that in his old Ford truck that had already been through it all, went in to Fred's, and remember, the man can barely walk, and he went into Fred's house. Fred's recovering and is going to recover, and Everett teared up, went to crying, and laid his hand on Fred's shoulder and said, "We're sure going to miss you when you're gone, Fred." That's the circumstance that we're talking about here. But Job's friends were worse than that, because they made this a matter of faith, if you see if I'm getting at. All right, now, come with us back to the text for a few minutes. We're about out of time here, but verse 24 and verse 22, Job says, basically, righteousness makes no difference if you look at it the way you guys are. In verse 24, the earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. Is it not he? Who then is it? So Job is saying, I mean, you read the papers, you watch the news today. How does it look? Yeah. All right. It doesn't look like justice is prevailing, does it, sometimes? And that's what Job is saying here. That's his answer to this man. Now, what Job says, beginning at verse 25, is intended to describe his own experience at the moment again. My days are swifter than a runner. They're like skiffs of reed, or like a little light boat made out of straws. It goes fast, but it sinks easily. It's like an eagle swooping on its prey. If I say, I'll just cheer up, I'll forget my complaint, I won't say anything more about this, then I become afraid of my suffering, and people say that I'm guilty. If I wash myself and I try to get up and get out of this, then I get plunged into the pit again. And here is what John was getting at a while ago, that where I said we're the only answer to Job's plight is, I think we could say what we generally call the incarnation. He says, verse 32 and 33, look at it. Tim, read again if you don't mind.
"For he is not a man as I am, that I may answer him, that we may go to court together. There is no umpire between us who may lay his hand upon us both."
All right, there is nobody. Job sees a situation where he doesn't understand what God is doing. He feels like he's being treated unjustly, but he finds no ground in which the case can be decided. There is no umpire who can lay his hand on both God and man and cause them to relate and to decide this case. How does that prepare the way for Jesus?
Jesus became that
mediator. Alright, Jesus is one who is God. He's one who is man. and who therefore is able to be a mediator between God and man like no one else ever can. He's able to be at God's right hand, but also to sympathize with our weaknesses. Why? Because he has in all points been tempted like as we are. In other words, since he has suffered, he is able to sympathize with sufferers. And that's what Job is missing in this case. Anybody who understands what it's like for him here, see. So, chapter 10 continues the discussion. We'll kind of use it to introduce our lesson next week about how Job is feeling about his life. Notice that he speaks more and more to God and less just to his friends as you're doing your reading. Follow that, but read chapters 10, 11, and 12. 12 and 13 even next week. We'll see how far we can work our way through the conversation. Remember, if you visit your friends this week, be a friend. Don't worry about being a defender of something. Okay, thank you very much.